So hang in there. This this little music break that we're having is 3 minutes and 49 seconds. And we'll be back with our great guest, Robert Powell, to talk about the Stephenville Lights. Yeah, I like that tune. Someone just wrote on the message board, sounds like Lindsey Buckingham. Yeah, I like Lindsey Buckingham a lot. I think he's underrated. Well, if you like that tune, you want to check out more, Moot Davis, you can go to his website. It's MOOTDavis.com. Anyway, we are ready to talk to our guest, Robert Powell. You can tell I'm feeling better. I'm not making all those hacking noises. Robert, how are you?
Hi, Martin. It's good to hear you again.
Yeah. So you're going to have to crawl up a little closer to your mic, I think. It sounds
okay.
a little bit quiet. And I'm going to do some adjusting here to see if I can fix it a little bit. And so, Robert, before we get into the Stephenville case, you are a man of science, and I'm always curious to find out why someone like you took a shine to the UFO topic. Can you give us your background and how you became interested?
Sure. Can you hear me okay now?
I I'm going to have to ask them in the chat room because you sound pretty quiet. So anyway, just go ahead if you would.
Okay. I first became interested in UFOs when I was a teenager. I read Alan Hynek's book, The UFO Experience, and I found that very interesting. And then there was a case that happened in Australia back in 1978. And at that time, I had just gotten out of college, and it was a very interesting case about a young pilot who had was flying from Australia to a small island, and then he disappeared, never to be heard from again. And they had, you know, the radio broadcast of him talking about this object circling his plane, and then you hear this crunching of metal. And ever since then, I was interested in UFOs. I did not stay active, though, until I took early retirement back in 2006. And that's ever since then, I've had the time to devote to this hobby, which I really enjoy.
Well, that's good. It's good for everybody because I know you've done a lot of great work. And, you know, we need to clone people like you. We need more people like you out there. And I sat through your presentation in Phoenix about the Puerto Rico UFO. I'm still undecided about that. And I heard you talking with Mark D'Antonio back and forth. That's still like an unexplained. I know we're not going to be talking much about that, but any developments on that since Phoenix?
No, nothing new since Phoenix on the Puerto Rico video. That one, in my mind, is the strangest video of a UFO that I've ever seen.
Yes, and if anyone wants to check that out, all you have to do is, I think it's on Open Minds. I know it is. I just don't know exactly where it is on there. You can also tell them what to Google. What would be the easiest thing to Google to catch that?
Yeah, they can Google on YouTube or Open Minds. If they just Google Puerto Rico Homeland Security, that's UFO, it. And yeah, that will find it for them.
And it's a long video, and the thing looks like it's turning, and then it does weird things in the water. Yeah, someone likes your accent on the message board. And I know they're not alone. A lot of people love the Texas accent. Sounds like good people. I've always enjoyed being in Texas. I spent some time in the Austin area. Also, in a place called Round Top, I was there for a week of antiquing. And I love the people of Texas. Very friendly. And I thought that's a place I wouldn't mind living just because the people are so friendly.
Round Top is a big antiquing place.
Right.
And my brother and I actually own the largest antique shop in East Texas, east of Canton.
We're going to have to talk offline because that's my business. That's what my real life. I love doing the show. You know, during the day, I'm an appraiser of fine arts and antiques. And I have been at that for several decades. So you and I are going to have to do some talking offline about the antiques business. All right. So let's talk about Stephenville. Let's go right into, first of all, what about the area of Stephenville and the people? Can you talk a little bit about that first?
Sure. Stephenville is a little different than most of the rest of Texas. It's about 70 miles southwest of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So most of your listeners probably know where the DFW area is. It's in north central Texas. So if you go 70 miles southwest, there's the town of Stephenville, which is in a county called Erath, E-R-A-T-H. And that's where most of this occurs. And Stephenville is really on a plateau. Most of Texas is low, around 600 feet above sea level. It's kind of plains. But Stephenville is on a plateau. Its population's about 25,000. It's the number one dairy producer in Texas. Texas is not known for its dairy cows, but Stephenville does have the most there. And probably the most interesting people in that city in terms of your listeners might be the singer Jewel. Mm-hmm. I believe she was married to Ty Murray, and they live in Stephenville. Hmm. But the people of Stephenville are they're very typical small town Texans. They're right underneath the flight path coming out of Fort Worth, out of Carswell Airport, what used to be called Carswell Air Force Base. Now it's called the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base. It's much easier to say Carswell. F-16s fly over Stephenville all the time, so the people of that community they're very used to seeing helicopters and jet aircraft.
Hmm. Which we'll be talking about a little bit more as we go into the case January 8th, 2008. Is that when the things first started happening there?
That's when the bulk of everything started, was January 8th, 2008. And I consider the event at Stephenville, it's the most significant UFO event since the Phoenix Lights. There hasn't been another one really that's come along that compares to this one.
You know, now that I think about it, you may be right, because that's 2008. You know, there were some mass sightings, mass sighting cases. I don't know if you'd consider this a mass sighting, pretty much. We have radar data. We've been talking about that later. Lots of witnesses. It didn't start out. It started out there was something like 17 witnesses that grew to 100, and I can let you get into all that. But as far as big mass cases, there was Tinley Park. I can't remember the dates of that. Of course,
that was around 2001, I believe, somewhere around there.
Okay. And Phoenix,
then there
of course,
was Chicago O'Hare.
Oh, that's right. Yep. That one, let's just talk quickly about that one, because the Chicago O'Hare Gate C-17 or whatever it is,
yep.
You know, that object was just sitting above the tarmac, just sitting there, shot up through the clouds, poked a hole right through the clouds. Lots of people saw it. And the one thing that I've mentioned to Leslie Kane, who did some work on that, is that you would just think that, you know, people in the airline business, whether they're a bag people out on the tarmac or they're working somewhere in the airport that could have seen this, they don't always stay in the airline business. They go off and do other things. And I'm really surprised at this point that we haven't heard from anyone saying, okay, I was one of the witnesses that couldn't talk. I want to tell you what I saw. I haven't heard anyone come forward like that. Have you?
No, I haven't heard anyone like that, although I did interview and I did an investigation of a guy who was on an aircraft that was flying into O'Hare at the time all of this occurred. And he did not report this until two years previous to today. So it was roughly 2 years ago. And what made his case very believable was that this guy kept his tickets all these years. So he still had his airplane ticket, so I could verify, you know, that plane did land at O'Hare during the exact time this event occurred. And he had a unique perspective to it that no one else had. He saw the object as the plane was above it, once the plane became basically level with it, and then, you know, as the plane landed, so he saw it from below. And his description was when he first saw it, it looked circular because he was looking from above. But when he was level with it, he said the object was definitely disc shaped. But if you look at it from, you know, if you look at a disc from below or from above, it's going to have a circular appearance.
Right. Well, that's amazing. So he contacted MUFON, obviously, and then you are in charge of you're on the STAR team, and so you were involved in the investigation. Is that how that happened?
Yes,
the connection.
Kind of how it happened. Actually, this individual contacted Patrick Nguyen, who's a he has the anomalous book site. Mm-hmm. He published the book we wrote, UFOs and Government. And so Patrick contacted me and told me about this guy. So then I contacted that individual and did a full investigation into his sighting report. And I put a copy of it into the MUFON database. And I sent a copy to Richard Haynes, who did the original work on the Chicago O'Hare case, so that he could add it to his files.
Wow. Really interesting. And so this guy waited for all this time and finally came forward. Do you know what changed his mind and what made him actually report this? I mean, he was not an employee. He was just on the plane.
I think I've seen this a lot in a lot of people. They don't report anything initially, and then they just at some point in time, they feel like they need to get it off their chest. So they report it. If he had not kept his airline tickets of the day, you know, when this happened, I would have been suspect, right, of his report.
Right.
But because he kept those tickets and I was able to verify those tickets and the aircraft were there and that his plane came in near C-17.
Amazing. So that's a great. And, you know, like I said, down the road, we may have more witnesses come forward. I'm sure it's going to happen sooner or later. And it's really like the gag order or whatever it is. It's really amazing that we just haven't heard from anyone. All right. So we got off track. We're going to get back to Stephenville. Can you talk about the incident? It all started with, I can't remember his name. They were out with a fire outside, right? A little like campfire, sitting around a campfire. Isn't that the first witnesses?
Well, actually, Martin, there was one witness who, his name was Ricky Sorrells. And it's worth bringing his case up because his case happened about a week and a half to 2 weeks before the January 8th, 2008
really?
Event.
Wow.
Right. And... So what happened with Ricky is, and he's a real good, he's just an old country boy, and he's very down to earth. And if anyone wants to Google him, they can kind of read about him. But basically, he went out, and he was deer hunting right before the sunset. And so he had his deer rifle with him. He was out hunting, and something made him look up. Probably because I think it was probably getting dark as this thing moved over him. And this object was so large that it basically blocked out most of the sky. And so he looks up at this object, and Ricky's a welder. And his main comment was there were no seams anywhere in this object. It was like it was molded out of a single piece.
Boy, you hear that so many times.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. And so the next day at work, you know, he told his buddies about it and they all laughed at him. And so he kind of put it aside, didn't think about it too much until January 8th rolled around when everyone in town started seeing these objects, not seeing them up close like what he saw, but they were seeing the bright lights. And as Ricky said, he felt vindicated because a week and a half earlier, when he saw this object, no one else, you know, was willing to believe him. So now we roll forward to January 8th. And the gentleman you mentioned, Steve, was the main witness. He was there with two of his friends and one of his friends' wife, and they were having a couple of beers. They were having a campfire when the sun had just set. It was still very bright outside when he sees these four extremely bright lights come out of the northeast, and the lights are moving towards the west. And he sees these extremely bright lights moving, and Steve happens to be a pilot. And so he estimates the speed at 3,000 miles per hour. Amazing. You know, in reality, there's no way he can really know how fast mm-hmm. this is going, right? But so he sees these lights move, and they continue to move west until they get approximately where the city of Stephenville is in terms of as the crow flies directly in that direction. Then the lights go from a horizontal to a vertical position. And instead of four lights, there's now 11 lights. So now these lights go into a vertical position. There's now 11 of them. And then all of a sudden, they just kind of like almost go into a large flame and then disappear.
Yeah, so, I remember the flame thing.
Yeah, so that was the first sighting. And so they went back into the house. And one of the four guys, it was Lance Jones, is a postal carrier. He left. He was kind of in shock. And, you know, he felt that, you know, it's kind of crazy, right? But I guess in his mind, he felt like, well, this could be the end of the earth. So he's headed back home. And so he's driving back, and all of a sudden he sees the lights again. So he calls Steve and tells him and the other two people, which is Mike Odom and Mike Odom's wife. He tells them the lights are coming back. And so they think he's kidding, but they go outside, and then they see the lights coming back after them. Not after them, but coming back across the same area, except this time there are two jets traveling behind the lights, trying to catch up with the lights, but they never do. And so that happened at about 6:15 p.m. that night. So that was the very first report. Now, you know, as reports go, if that was all we had ever heard, the Stephenville case would not be that. It would be an interesting case, but it wouldn't be one of these unusual cases that you get every 10 years or so. What made it unusual is what happened next. For the next 3 hours, reports came in all over that county from various individuals who were seeing these lights. So this was not an incident of several witnesses at one location. This was an incident of many, many witnesses at many, many different locations and across 3 hours of time. Now, that's really unusual, and that's what makes this such an interesting case.
Very much like the Phoenix Lights.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Very much like the Phoenix Lights. And what drew my attention to the case, I was the director of research, so I usually monitor the reports that come into MUFON. And on average, MUFON gets about 20 reports a day all across the U.S. and actually across the entire world, but 80% of our reports come from the U.S. Well, the first thing that I noticed was all of a sudden we had 5, 6, 7 reports within 24 hours all out of the same county. Now, that's unusual. And then after the next 24 hours, the number of reports went up to 20 reports and more. So that is something to this day I have not seen. And I've been in MUFON since the beginning of 2007. So that was a very unusual occurrence. So once we saw that, we knew something was happening, and several MUFON investigators, among myself, the state director, and field investigators all across Texas, went to actually Dublin, Texas, which is 10 miles southwest of Stephenville. And we met at the Dublin Rotary Club with their building. We borrowed their building. And that's where we first interviewed the witnesses.
What was that like?
That was like a circus. The reason, and, you know, looking back, if we were to do this again, I would never interview witnesses in that type of situation, because we had media. This really hit the media, and the media got very interested, which doesn't happen like this very often. And so we go into this building, and every news station's there. I mean, there must have been 7, 8, 9 different media outlets, and each outlet had 3 or 4 media people manning their cameras and everything. In addition, we had probably 20 witnesses in that building. And trying to interview the witnesses, you couldn't even hear yourself think. So that was not a success in terms of interviewing witnesses. Now
do you think sorry to interrupt you, but do you think anyone got like caught up in that and maybe over embellished, or did you get a chance at a later time to talk to these people one on one?
Yes, I talked to a lot of the key witnesses one-on-one, and I made trips. I live in Austin, and I'm about 2 hours, 2 1/4 hours south of Stephenville. So I probably have made 6, 7, or 8 trips up to Stephenville to talk to various witnesses. And I found that most of the witnesses – they weren't out there looking for UFOs. They were familiar with what F-16s look like because they fly over Stephenville 2 or 3 times a week. So that was nothing unusual to them. But these people their questions to me were like, we just want to know what it is. Is this something our military has? You know, that was usually the most common question. Is this some new military aircraft that's been developed?
Mm-hmm.
And very few of them jumped to a conclusion that, you know, these were aliens.
Now, the one thing that about this statement you're just making right now, from what I understand, the witnesses all or mostly said this thing was absolutely huge, like 2 football fields or longer or something like that. Now,
well, you know,
go ahead.
That's one thing that kind of gets changed by the media, right, is reports come out. There were witnesses who saw a huge object, right, like Ricky Sorrell. And there was 2 policemen, 3 actually, 3 policemen in Stephenville, which saw a huge object. But the rest of the witnesses basically just saw the lights. They didn't see the actual physical object.
Wow.
So that's kind of a difference between what the witnesses saw and what the media reports. The media does make it sound like every witness saw this huge, gigantic object.
Now, let me just ask you this. Were the lights only on one side of it?
The witnesses that saw the lights, like Steve Allen and his group, the one I talked about earlier, they're the ones who saw the 4 lights. Other witnesses just saw a single very bright light. And then another witness, the constable, actually saw, and I think he's the best witness of all. He initially saw 2 single lights, and then later, those 2 single lights became, he estimated, between 9 and 11 individual lights.
Really something. We had an email message just came in. Someone wanted to ask you. And by the way, you can email questions. I can try to catch them as I'm going along here. You can also jump in our chat room if you want to pose the guest a question. And we just found out tonight, because Alejandro had to call in, that our phone system worked. I hope it keeps working. So if you'd like to call in at any point and ask our guest a question or two, that number is 603-967-4030. Now, the question was sent in by Carrie. He sent in a number of interesting questions lately. And so the question to you is, do you think that there is a more sophisticated radar facility such as NORAD notifying localized military bases that UFOs are going to be entering their airspace? giving them kind of a, you know, warning, so to speak, just to have their jets ready to scramble or anything like that. Do you think that's possible?
Well, I mean, I could say that's possible. Of course, there's no way for me to know whether that's true or not, right? Because the military is not going to provide that type of information.
Good point. Know? Yes.
So, yeah. And I'll go into that a little bit later.
When we talk about the radar data, that's really very, very, very important to this case. Now, what night was it that this thing started heading toward Crawford Ranch, George Bush's ranch?
That was the same night. That was January the 8th, 2008.
All right. Can you kind of go over how that played out? You said for 3 hours people were seeing this. How far away is the ranch from Stephenville?
Okay, the ranch is really not close to Stephenville. The ranch is about 60 miles southeast of Stephenville.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in a totally different direction. And I actually found that object on radar by accident. Well, not by accident, but as part of the investigation. So I'm just going to jump back to when we had this big media frenzy, right?
Okay, sure.
Well, one of the good things that came out of that was I met Angela Joyner, who was the newspaper reporter who, you know, broke this entire case open.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a guy by the name of Glenn Schultz, who was a former Army radar expert. And somehow Angela had found Glenn, and Glenn was out of Colorado, so he drove all the way to Stephenville from Colorado to be part of, you know, this whole thing. And so I got to meet Glenn. And the important part of that is Glenn showed me how to do radar analysis. Now, I have a science background, but I was not a radar expert. But Glenn was a radar expert. And so once he explained to me the information that we got from the FAA, it became, you know, pretty routine on how to analyze the radar data. And once we got this radar data, the very first thing we did is we checked out that we were capable of properly analyzing it. The way we did that is we followed the F-16s out of Carswell Air Force Base. So we picked up the F-16s on radar. So that way we knew where the F-16s were at every moment in time. And there were a total of 10 F-16s that came out of Carswell that night. So then once we had identified where the F-16s were, we then started to look for objects on radar that did not have what's called a transponder. In other words, there's no transponder code that's being beamed out. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's purely the radar beam hitting an object and bouncing back to the radar site.
Mm.
Well, Glenn and I had obtained 5 different radar sites from the FAA. We'd sent a Freedom of Information request. So we got that from the FAA.
Before we move on.
Sure.
I've heard that that's impossible to do these days.
It is. Okay. They pretty well shut it down since those days.
Okay. So right after you got this, or like a few years after?
Glenn and I made follow-up requests for radar data on other cases that came after this. And then that's when they started to basically shut down the release of radar data from the FAA. You can still get it, but it's not the same type. They don't... We were able to get radar data on individual radar sites. What they do now is, like where we had 5 radar sites, they would take all that data and just merge it into one big pile of data. And they no longer will tell us, okay, which radar site provided that information. Oh. They just, you know, so they kind of scramble it, which is not, you know, that makes it much more difficult to pick something up. So we got all this radar data. First thing we did was we identified the F-16s. Then I went to each of the witnesses that I had interviewed because I knew the time where they were at, you know, their exact location. I knew where they were looking in the sky, and I knew where they were located. So then I looked at the radar data to see, okay, does radar pick up an object? And of all the witnesses, the most interesting one was the constable who he and his son had seen the objects. This was about an hour after Steve Allen and his group had. And the constable was about 10 miles southwest of where Steve was and where he was at home. And he goes outside and he sees these two lights. He estimates that the lights are about 2 miles away. That's his guess. He goes back into the house to get his wife to come out and look at these things. And his wife was watching, I guess, her favorite TV show. And she said, no, I'm not coming out. But his, you know, she had more important things to do.
Oh, yeah.
but his son came out. So he goes back out and the two lights are gone. But instead, there are 11 lights just moving, as he described them, just dancing in the sky above his head.
Wow.
So the first two lights he saw were to his southwest. Then when he comes back out, now those are gone, and there's 9 to 11 lights dancing around. He goes to get his binoculars to get a better look. And as he's looking at them with his binoculars, these randomly moving lights, suddenly they don't come together as one light, but instead they all 11 begin to move together to the northeast. And the constable says he doesn't know the speed. He just says it's like, you know, he was exaggerating, but he said it was like the speed of light. He says, you know, basically they head to the northeast and in a second they're just gone. So I got the radar data and I said, okay, let's see what happened at the time the constable was there. So I look at the same time that the constable said he went outside and he knew what time it was because his wife was watching her favorite show. And on the radar data, there's an object that's actually, I think he got lucky on guessing how far away it was because there's an object on radar 2 miles southwest of his home. And this object is barely moving. It's like 25, 35 miles an hour. There's very little movement.
Which is impossible to stay afloat unless it's lighter than air, like helium or something.
Yeah, or a helicopter.
All right. Yeah, of course.
And so it's moving to the southeast. And all of a sudden, this object that I'm tracking on radar, on the next sweep of the radar, and the radar sweeps every 10 seconds, all of a sudden this object has moved to the northeast, the exact location, the exact distance and direction that the constable said it did. Well, based on the radar data, this object moved at 1,900 miles an hour, which for the constable, an object moving at that speed at low altitude is going to basically disappear within a second. I mean, it's there, then it's gone because a car's moving a mile a minute, right, at 60 miles an hour, and this is 30 times that fast. So now you're talking about an object that's moving 1 to 2 miles a second. So it's going to disappear from view very rapidly. And that's basically what he described, and that's what showed up on radar. So that was the most I was, like, shocked when I saw that.
Now, just for the listener, what are you looking at when you're looking at radar data? Is it a screen? Is it paper? What is it exactly?
What you get from the FAA is paper. Uh-huh. It's a digital file. And basically, you have data that every 10 seconds is this radar sweeps. Anything it hits shows up on this data. So we had like 500,000 objects that showed up across these 5 radar sites all over Texas. So then what you have to do is you have to narrow everything out by time and location, right? So I know what the latitude longitude coordinates are of every radar point. And so I know the latitude longitude coordinates of where the constable lives. So I'm looking for any movement that shows up on radar within that area of where he lives. And I'm looking for how that object moves over time, right? So the first data point is, say, 7 hours, 15 minutes, and 10 seconds, right? So 7, 15, and 10 seconds. So I pick up an object, let's say, to the southwest of him. Well, in 10 more seconds, I pick up that same object to the southwest, except now it's moved. So, you know, now it's just tracking that object's movement. So it took a lot of work. I would say Glenn and I put in hundreds of hours of work.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the Crawford Ranch object, right? Once we finish, remember the sequence was we looked at the F-16s, then we looked at, okay, where were the witnesses and what did we see there? Then we just started looking for objects without transponders that were moving anywhere on that day. And that's when we picked up the object moving towards Crawford Ranch.
Yeah.
And, right. What was interesting about that was we had 140 hits on that object. So it wasn't two or three or four radar hits. It was over 140. And in general, the object was moving at 40 miles an hour. But there would be times, and there was one time where the speed went from 40 miles an hour to 500 miles an hour in the course of two sweeps of the radar. So in 20 seconds, this object goes from 40 miles an hour to 500.
What is the G-force of something like that?
Oh, that would be huge. And that's a minimum, what I just gave you, because, right, I only know what it does every 10 seconds. It could have done that, right, since there was two sweeps of the radar. It could have done it 11 seconds in, not necessarily at 20, but I'm doing worst case. So I'm saying, okay, if it's at 20. At 20 seconds, I don't think a human would survive going from 20 to, you know, 40 miles an hour to over 500 miles an hour. And then the really crazy thing, and then it immediately slowed down on the very next sweep down to around 150, 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So that's just not something you would do.
Not with the technology that we know about that we have. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, none of this matches our technology. Just like the object moving at 1,900 miles an hour, we can do that with jets, but not at low altitude. They've got to get up high where the air is thinner.
And what about noise? I mean, this thing didn't make any noise. That's what I heard when I was looking into this.
And anything moving at 1,900 miles an hour has got to make a sonic boom.
Oh, so it escaped the sonic boom.
Yeah.
There's theories about that. I've heard different theories about how that could be done. And so we're right at the top of the hour. What we're going to get into in the second hour is we're going to talk about Angelina. I'm sorry, what is it? Yeah, Angelina Joyner's role in this whole thing. That's a name that I had heard a lot when I started looking into this a number of years ago. We're also going to talk about a football game that it was a mass sighting of in the area and a whole bunch more. So come and support the show. You can listen to hour two. And we are heading live still with Robert Powell, and we're talking about the Stephenville case. Again, the phone line is open, and as far as we know, it might actually work finally. That's 603-967-4030. We have a question that is coming up. I'm going to ask you a little bit later in the chat room. You're welcome to join the chat room and pose a question for the guest. So what was Angelina Joyner's involvement? She actually broke this. She was involved in the newspaper there, and she was involved in this for a long time. Is that right?
Yes. Angela, she broke the story and was involved in it from the beginning to the end.
And how long was that? Because I know she's not, I tried to get a hold of her a number of times and she just had no interest in being on the show. So she's, and do you know why?
Well, I think Angela has kind of dropped out of the whole UFO thing. She was very active in it for 2 or 3 years, maybe 4. And I know Angela well, and I've met her and we've talked a lot. And this is my personal opinion of why she dropped out is there were a lot of people who would come to her and tell her about some case they had. And I think she got burned out because of so many people that would, you know, basically, whether they were intending to or not, they were pulling her leg, that they weren't real cases.
Oh.
And she just felt like it was a rabbit hole she was getting sucked down into.
That's a shame.
That's my feel.
Yeah. Now, what happened when she first contacted the Air Force to ask about the 2 or more F-16s?
Well, she contacted the Air Force 2 days later, and she talked to a Major Carl Lewis. And Angela described him as a very gregarious public relations officer. And he was a lot of fun to talk to. She said he came up with some theories on perhaps, you know, it was a commercial airliner with the sun glinting off its, you know, metal frame. But he went on to say that, you know, he would check into it and give her some more theories. And he also said there were no F-16s up in the air at that time. Now, from what I've just told you, there was something he did which was incorrect. And that was because ever since 1969, the Air Force has gotten out of UFOs.
Right.
So if you call an Air Force base and say, hey, I've seen a UFO, their public relations officer is not supposed to start talking to you about what it might be, what it could be, et cetera, et cetera. He's simply supposed to state that the U.S. Air Force does not investigate UFOs and, you know, contact MUFON or contact the National UFO Reporting Site, et cetera. So that was the mistake he made. And the second mistake he made was he said there were no F-16s in the air. Now, I can tell you from having been up there investigating the case and talking to the witnesses, that really upset the local people in Stephenville.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it did is because they see F-16s 2-3 times a week.
So they know what they are. They know what they saw.
They know what they look like. They know what they sound like.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Air Force to say there were no F-16s in the air when they saw F-16s in the air was an insult to the local citizenry.
Right.
And that really got them upset. Well, 2 weeks later, roughly, Major Carl Lewis, he didn't call Angela Joyner back. He actually called a different AP reporter by the name of Angela Brown. And Angela and he basically told her that there were F-16s in the air that night. So Angela Joyner started contacting the major, trying to find out, you know, why didn't you tell me and what's going on? And she never could get him to return her call until finally one day she finally catches him on the phone. And she told me, she said, Robert, this guy who is so gregarious, once I asked him and I said, well, Major Lewis, what happened? You told me there weren't F-16s. And she said it was just like he was reading from a script.
Oh.
He would say, Angela, all I can tell you is we had X number of F-16s in the air on January 8th, 2008. And she said, well, yeah, but what else can you tell me? All I can tell you is we had, you know, F-16s in the air. And so she said this gregarious guy had suddenly just, she felt he'd been read the riot act. And I bet he had, because he was never supposed to have carried on a conversation with her about UFOs in the first place.
Absolutely. Now, I want to, there's a message I'm going to be asking a question on, because I want to talk about a little bit later on about the debunkers. You've mentioned the shining reflection off of a airliner which is absolutely crazy, you know, nighttime sighting and all that. I want to talk about the ranch, and I want to talk about what happened. I would think that is protected airspace around a president's home, whether even today, I'm sure it is. Excuse me. And protected airspace is protected. It's big fines if anyone flies in there. The jets had scrambled. Did they follow this thing all the way down to George W. Bush's ranch?
No, they didn't. I mean, as far as the jets were concerned, there was only one time where I saw what appeared to be a reaction of the F-16s to this unknown object. Because I knew where the F-16s were at every moment in time, right? And I knew where the witnesses were. So I know where the witnesses are looking. I know where the F-16s are. So, and the witnesses even know what the F-16s look like too. So the F-16s really are not an issue in terms of misidentifying, an F-16.
Right. But what I'm wondering is they're going directly toward Crawford Ranch, which is protected airspace. Why didn't the F-16s follow it, were they scrambled?
That's an excellent question, Martin. And I, to this day, I don't have a good answer for that. I can tell you there was a private pilot prior to this event who flew too close to the Crawford Ranch. And when he was told, via radio to get out of that restricted airspace. And when he landed, he was met by Secret Service agents. Mm-hmm. And I think they just temporarily arrested him and then let him go. But that's a serious event.
Right.
Well, when this object, we ran out of radar data, it was a beeline towards Crawford Ranch, and it was 10 miles away, and it would have been over Crawford Ranch within the next very few minutes. And there was absolutely no reaction on the part of any of the F-16s that were in the air at that time, which I think is very strange.
It is.
Additionally, I found two witnesses who were witnesses to the object who lived near Crawford Ranch. They lived 2 miles from where the president lived. And they were out riding their bikes that evening and saw a light come towards Crawford Ranch. I suspect it was the same light that was on radar, although there's no way to know absolutely. So that's kind of the story on Crawford Ranch.
We don't know, because you ran out of radar information, that you don't know for sure if it actually flew right over it. And the people that were 2 miles away, did they see it head straight toward the ranch?
Yeah. The people that were 2 miles away, the light they saw was coming from the same direction that it showed to be coming on the radar screen. What they saw basically was an object that they described as roughly five times as bright as Jupiter. Mm. And I went and met with the husband and wife and talked to them. They had a very good feel for astronomy. I asked them where was Orion's belt. They were familiar with the stars in Orion. They were familiar with the major planets and the brightness level. And they described this when they said this thing was five times as bright as Jupiter. What they meant was not just in brightness, but that you would take five Jupiters and lay them side by side. So they felt that there was a length to the light. It wasn't just a single point. So they said this object was coming down towards the ground. And as it got near the ranch. They said all of a sudden the object just took off at a high rate of speed parallel to the ground, and within 1 to 2 seconds was gone. So that's what they claimed that they saw.
Oh, okay.
And their story matched up with what I saw on radar. So there's when I last saw the object on radar, right, the object was roughly 10 miles from Crawford Ranch. It was moving at 40 miles an hour. It would have been over Crawford Ranch in, what, roughly 10 minutes. And it had been moving in a straight line for over an hour. So I'm 90% confident that if I had had the additional radar data, the object continued on over, you know, Crawford Ranch. But in terms of the F-16s, I would have thought they should have picked this object up also with their radar systems. And there was also a AWACS aircraft in the area that night because we picked it up on radar. So they had to have seen it. So as to why there was no reaction to it, I don't know.
Wow. No kidding. I mean, you just think that it's such a, you know, President Bush was in office at the time. No, he wasn't. He was just out of office, right?
No, he was in office, but he was not at Crawford Ranch. But even if the president's there, your no-fly zone is, I'm doing this off the top of my head, I think it's either 6 or 9 miles in all directions.
Right.
If he's not there, I think the no-fly zone is either 3 miles, maybe 6, but I think it's 3 miles.
Right. Now, okay, so this happened. This was all this stuff happened on January 8th. So many days go by, and the constable is out checking on an alarm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, but, you know, and I've seen this a lot in UFO cases. The constable was checking on alarm. He saw a light in the sky, and he thought it might have been the object again. I was never able to, establish for sure that it really was.
All right. See, that's what happens when you're looking into things. You can get a little misinformation.
What happens a lot of times with a lot of witnesses, it happened with Steve Allen. I mean, he put out a reward of $500 for anyone that could bring him a videotape, right? Mm. So someone brings him a videotape, and it was basically a star or a planet, a bright star or planet. And their video system goes into overexposure, right, because there's not enough light. And so you see this squiggly shape, right? And that's why, because the video camera's overexposing to try to pick up the star's light.
Yeah, I've done that by accident myself, you know, just being out with even my iPhone, and you see streaks of light. And, you know, it's funny, you do see a lot of people like posting, oh, this UFO, when all it is your camera moving, basically, that causes the streak. I did see the little bit of video that he took of it. It looks unusual. It actually looks like there's one posted now that was seen in Alabama that's up on Open Minds. Looks very similar to that. It's kind of like a sparkling light head-on, almost like what your could be some type of planet or something like that, but I don't know. The question up on the message board, and I want to get a little bit into the debunking because there was plenty of that, and there always is anytime there's a major case. It's been suggested that there was actually 10 F-16s performing military maneuvers in the Brownwood Military Operations Area and dropping flares. The military initially denied activity in the area, then reversed itself, admitting to this activity. A new press release was released, admitting the activity. So what do you think about their explanation?
I'm trying to read into the question because it wasn't clear to me there. It sounds like you're saying, okay, could a military flares have caused?
This was their explanation. Now, this is a message on the message board, so I'm not sure if this could be picked up again by reading about this case and may be inaccurate. I'm not sure. It said the military initially denied the activity and then they reversed itself and admitted to the activity, basically saying that they dropped flares. Do you know anything about them admitting they dropped flares?
When the Air Force came back and said F-16s were in the area, they did not say the F-16s dropped flares. Okay. There was a debunker, I think it was McGaha, who said that the F-16s dropped flares. There's a number of problems with that whole argument. And the problem with in the Stingville case, I've yet to see anyone come in and do a detailed analysis that's a debunker to say, okay, here's what happened, blah, blah, blah. Since Glenn and I had the radar data, we knew where the F-16s were all the time. So there's no question that what the direction the witnesses were looking was not in the direction where the F-16s were. So it's kind of hard for the F-16s to be igniting flares if they're not in the direction that's being observed by the witnesses. Additionally, when Steve Allen saw the flares, or what I guess someone might say, okay, they were flares. The problem, for example, with those being flares, was he was looking to the northeast. Northeast of his position is not a military operating area. So that would mean the military had to be dropping flares over civilian areas. Not only that, but that entire area was in a no burn. We have a lot of that in Texas because it's so dry. Mm-hmm. And a flare hitting the ground could have caused a major fire problem.
Sure.
Additionally, there were no F-16s on radar to the northeast of his position. So that doesn't, jive either. And then for the flares, as he said, right, he said the objects moved from the east to the west, and then they stopped moving. Well, the defensive-type flares that are fired by F-16s, and I know exactly what they look like because I actually saw flares not during this time frame, but about 8 months later, and I actually went up with a pilot who we were in, I guess, some type of Piper Cub, and we flew right up next to the military operating area. He didn't want to go into the military operating area. This was about 9 months after all this happened. And we saw the flares and we saw the F-16s being dropped, dropping the flares at night. So these are defensive flares. The flares don't move across the sky, and the flares certainly don't move from horizontal positions into a vertical position and then stand still and then disappear in a flash.
Right.
Flying.
Now, what about you said so there wasn't a lot of debunkers of this case. Is that what you?
Right. The only two that I've ever seen that tried to do it was McGaha, who is what I just told you. Oh, and then his other argument was, he says, Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell must have just pulled points out of the air to create the radar data, which is just the silliest thing. I mean, McGaha doesn't even know how to do radar analysis. So for him to say that, I just don't have a lot of respect for most debunkers.
I don't mind skeptics because I think we all should be skeptic to take, a really good look at something. But when it comes to debunking, it's just.
I agree. I mean, I don't mind skeptics. I'm a skeptic. I'm skeptical of everything until I can analyze it. But so that was McGaha's. And then a guy by the name of Tim Prenti made a claim that, those were F-16s. And there are so many reasons that argument's not true. I mean, for one, even without the radar data, all the witnesses in that area, they see F-16s at least 3 to 4 times a week.
Right.
And then on top of that, I have the radar data, so I know where the F-16s are, because when I analyzed the data, the very first thing I did is I didn't go look for the UFOs. The first thing Glenn and I did is we tracked the F-16s. We tracked them out of Fort Worth. We tracked them over Stephenville. We tracked them into the military operating area. And we picked up, like I said, we picked up that there was an AWACS flying a figure eight over that entire area of Texas. So that was probably part of their operation. But the most interesting, and this is the only time on radar we saw a reaction of the F-16s to what was happening. There were four F-16s that took off right around 6:15. And then a second set of four came out of Cardswell around 7 o'clock. Meanwhile, a little bit earlier, around 6:45, there were two F-16s that went northwest to Oklahoma. So in your mind, Oklahoma is directly north of Texas. And so they're at a military operating base west of Oklahoma City. And we see them on radar. And they're doing their, you can see the jets doing their maneuvers. And then at about 8 o'clock, if I remember correctly, it's either 8 or 8:30. These two jets, instead of flying back to Carswell, which is a short distance, instead, these two jets fly south down to, they don't even go into the military operating area in Texas. They fly south into Texas. And then they fly east over Stephenville and Dublin, or Dublin and Stephenville, and then continue back to Fort Worth. So if you pull out a map and look at that, that's going a long ways out of your way, and to not even go into a military operating area, but to fly over Dublin and Stephenville, to me looked like someone told them, go down there and see if anything is still going on. You know, that would be my best guess. Oh,
yeah, that kind of like almost spells it out. Really?
Yeah.
So I am not, I don't want to say I'm challenging. I'm asking someone, if you'd like to call in, I want to check to make sure my phone works. So if you have a guest and you thought about typing it in the chat room and you feel up for it, can you give us a call? 603-967-4030. I just want to see if my phone works. If you're shy, it's okay. Because I've been looking into different phone services. I can't really figure out one that's going to work. So I'd really like to know if my phone works. So you can call just to say hi. So if you'd like to call, we'll see if that'll work, Robert.
Okay.
Yeah. The radar to me is really something. Now, when you were looking at the radar, you were only seeing one object, is that right?
No, I believe we were seeing multiple objects.
Oh, okay.
I mean, right, you can never say absolutely that these weren't all connected, but I'm pretty sure they were different objects, because the first object we saw was the one near the constable's home. And then the object that went to Crawford Ranch, that object, I'm pretty sure, was a different object. So I don't believe those two are related. So those seem to be two different objects. And then when Steve Allen had that first sighting, remember when he saw it first at 6:15, we actually picked up two hits on radar at the time he was there and in the direction. And on the two hits, the object's moving in the same direction he's talking about. But even though the time is correct and the location is correct, I like to have more than two hits to really feel good. I mean, I think there's a reasonable chance that that is exactly what was on radar, is what Steve Allen saw. But compare that to like the constable, where we had somewhere around 20 or 30 hits on radar, and the object moving to Crawford, where we had over 140 hits on radar. So that I felt very good about the object the constable saw, as well as the object that was moving towards Crawford.
Now, did you send a Freedom of Information Act request to the military to see if they talked about this object at the time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's military bases all over that part of Texas. There's Fort Hood, which, you know, is basically the staging area for most of our troops that go over to the Middle East. And Fort Hood has an airport. And I know they've got a radar site, right? Mm-hmm. And we sent them a Freedom Information request for, you know, the radar data and whether or not they had any, you know, aircraft in the air. We did the same thing with Dyess Air Force Base, which is in Abilene, Texas. I sent the same request to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, to Carswell, which is in, you know, Fort Worth area. And I sent one to Space Command, in Colorado Springs, which is part of NORAD. And except for the reply from the FAA and the reply from Carswell Air Force Base, every other reply was exactly the same. And the reply was, here, and this is quote, "We have no information responsive to your request." Now think about that. What does that mean? We have no information responsive to your request. I mean, that's not saying yes. That's not saying no. I mean, that's basically some attorney that's drawn up a reply for them that says we're not answering.
Yeah. It's like a blanket reply.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing. So now when you send a FOIA, do you always get some type of request?
You mean response?
Yes. Response, I meant, yes.
Normally, we don't always. Sometimes you get no response at all. But most of the time, you'll get, you know, at least the response that says we have no information.
Okay, hang on. We have a caller. Thank you, caller. Thank you, caller. I think this is working, actually. Hey, who do we have on the line?
It's Bobby, Martin. How you doing, man?
Hey, Bobby. I met Bobby. I haven't actually talked to you. And since we met in Carolina, if I'm talking about the right Bobby, what,
That's
3
right.
years
That's
ago?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Now you're supposed to be at work now or something.
No, I get off at 9.
Oh, all right. So do you have a thanks for calling, Bobby. I'm glad to see that our phone is now working. I'm really excited about that. And do you have a question for Robert?
Actually, I've got two things. First, I want to thank him because I love my SSD drives. I see that he worked for Advanced Micro Devices and helped develop the flash drive. That's just awesome.
Yeah.
And the second thing is I wondered if he could speak about there was a hunter in Stephenville that was out hunting and actually saw a large, gigantic crack overhead and actually looked at it through a scope. I wonder if he had talked to him and could elaborate a little bit on that. And I'll take my answers off the phone.
All right. Good to talk to you, Bobby.
Hey, you too, man. Take care.
All right, you too. Now, Bobby didn't hear the first part of the story because he, like he said, he just gets out of work at 9 and gets on late. But you actually talked about that earlier, talking about the hunter. Did you actually speak to him in person?
Yeah, I've met Ricky Sorrells in person 2 or 3 times. Ricky's a very believable type guy. And when he first reported this object when he was out hunting, his comment was, you know, I hope this is something our military has. So it's not like, you know, these guys are out trying to make up some stories. They're like, you know, I don't know what that was, but I certainly hope it was ours. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Ricky had said the object was molded almost like it was a solid piece.
Right. Yeah.
He's a welder, and so he was looking for seams, and he saw no seams. The other thing he saw were these circular cone-shaped indentions in the craft. He said they were symmetrically placed all across the bottom, and he said they were indented a certain distance. He didn't know exactly how far. He thought each circular area was probably 6 feet across, was his guess. And when the craft departed, the thing that he said, which is, you know, interesting, is he said the object took off at a 45-degree, you know. And he says the object, it's not like it tilted or anything. It stayed flat just like it was and just took off at 45 degrees. There was no sound. There was no rush of wind. I mean, there should have been a huge rush of wind for an object of that size to have suddenly at high speed departed from you.
Right.
I mean, should have almost sucked him up like a vacuum, you know, with a vacuum it created.
Sure.
As it took off. But none of that happened.
This is such a mystery. The whole, you hear about these type of things. Now, you could almost speculate that those indented areas, the cones, symmetrical areas, could be some type of propulsion. You know, you could almost surmise it might have something to do with propulsion, or, you know, it's all only guessing. But
right, it's only guessing. The only thing that, I mean, I might try to guess is that for an, you know, for an object of that size to depart at that speed and not have created any wind or, you know, anything like that, or for him not to have felt any heat, it's almost like, I mean, I don't know how to say it, but I mean, basically it's like you're not really physically here, right? I mean, it's like you're, because you're not abiding by the laws of physics. So either you're,
right,
you know, in some type of warped area of space or something. I don't know. But, I mean, it doesn't make any sense that that happens. But I've heard this type of report many times of a large object that takes off at a high rate of speed, and it's close to the witness, and the witness feels no air movement or anything.
Yeah, it's spooky. It's almost, and you also have to realize, let's just say this was an extraterrestrial craft. I'm not saying that I'm saying it is, but let's just speculate that it is. They got, if that's so, they got here from wherever they got, is like something we can't even fathom. So they know something about physics that we don't. If they did that, and as well as these other capabilities, it's all something about physics that we're not aware of, or we haven't figured out yet, if we ever do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for us, it's almost like, can you imagine a squadron of F-16s flying back to the days of Christopher Columbus?
And, that's a good point. Yeah.
I mean, what would they figure out? Not much.
There's a person that's an engineer on the chat room, and he's saying that he thinks that it's only 1G to do 40 to 520 seconds. Was there any other movements that you're aware of that were would be more detrimental to, say, a human inside of that craft, if it was the only way you'd be able to tell? Now, I do want to say this. The eyewitness, one of the eyewitnesses, said that he saw it from almost stop taking off to a real high rate of speed. And but are you familiar with any other type of movement that would kind of defy G-force that we can handle as humans?
Well, that object that I was referring to from 40 to 500 miles an hour in 20 seconds, that's the object that was moving towards Crawford Ranch. The object that was near the Constable, that object on radar basically went from standing still to 1,900 miles an hour. The only thing you can say is that at the most it took 10 seconds, right? Because the radar only sweeps every 10 seconds. If you took an average, you'd say, well, it did it in 5 seconds. But I'm sure that's a lot more than one to two, you know, one, two, three, or four G's. I haven't calculated how many G's to go from zero to 1,900 miles an hour in 10 seconds, you know, or 5 seconds. But the other thing that makes no sense is there was no breaking of the sound barrier.
Yes. Yeah, that's another puzzling thing. Again, you do hear it a lot, and you hear it almost all the time. I mean, I don't think, as far as I know, I've heard many, many times where the thing shoots off, whatever it is, at a high rate of speed. Not once have I ever heard anyone talk about that object, an object breaking the sound barrier when it did that. Are you familiar with any any case where they talk about the sound barrier being broken?
I don't know of one where an individual saw an object leave at a high rate of speed and heard the sound barrier break.
Right, right. So that's just one of those interesting things. Now, several months, up to 9 months, I can't remember exactly when, there was a football game. Is that just hearsay, or was that part of something that happened at Stephenville?
The I know what you're referring to. This happened at a football game in a city called the Hilo. I believe it's Hilo. That happened in either October or November of that year. So it was about 5-6 months later. I think that that case was flares, because the reason I say that is because the object that was seen at the football game, or the, you know, the lights that were seen were in the direction of the military operating area. I mean, if I've seen the flares myself in that military operating area,
mm-hmm.
because the Air Force releases them all the time. And you can see these flares at a distance of almost 60 miles.
Right.
And at 60 miles, you can hardly, you don't really see the F-16s anymore,
mm-hmm.
Because the only thing you would see of them would be their red green lights, which they may or may not be using in a military operating area. It's not a requirement. So that what you have to do in the case of flares is you have to look at, you know, where the witness is at, where was the military operating area at, where were the F-16s at, and so can flares be a reasonable explanation? And I think in the case of the football stadium in October to November, that I think that's probably what happened. You know, you have to realize that once an event like this happens, it makes people overly sensitive.
Exactly. I was just going to say
anything.
That. People will be looking up in the sky that never did before. And there'll be exaggerations. And sure, I absolutely understand that. So was there any repeat of this incident, or was it a one-off? Except for there was two times, the Hunter and January 8th. Was there any other incidents of this object?
As far as I know, I have to kind of say it was a one-off, Martin, in that there were reports that occurred later. Maybe they're real reports. There's no way for me to know absolutely, but they were individual reports, right? One witness sees something. He puts out a report. There were no mass sightings other than the time that it happened, you know, at that football game, which was about 7 to 8 months later.
Right. If anyone on the message board wants to pose a question regarding Stephenville or want to call in at 603-967-4030. Otherwise, I might move into asking some other things. So if you have questions about that, please do post them on the message board or call in. So I'd kind of, if we're not going to stay on this for the next 15 minutes or so, I want to ask you, what do you personally think happened?
Well, I don't believe that it was military. I just do not believe that we have the capability to move an object at 1900 miles an hour at low altitude, and especially within basically one, you know, in less than 10 seconds. So that makes me feel like it's not military.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, when you asked earlier, Martin, I'm still puzzled by why there was not a reaction from the F-16s when that object that's on radar was moving towards Crawford Ranch. Because realize that if we saw it on FAA radar, that it was definitely seen on military radar. And not only that, the military has access to all of the civilian radar through what's called the Joint Surveillance System.
They do. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, but I never thought of it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, after we stopped getting FAA radar data, the way we would get it is we would request that radar data from the military. Same civilian radar station, and we were able to get it sometimes.
Wow. Interesting.
So I don't think the object there was anything related to our military, you know, other than that, I would just be guessing as to, you know, where the object came from, right? I just don't believe it's anything we could have developed.
Yeah. And what about the final thing? What about what do the key witnesses think it was?
I know the constable and Steve Allen and the group he was with, they felt that it was, you know, in the beginning, they wondered if it was military. But as time went by, they felt like it was not military. They felt it was probably, you know, I guess their best guess would have been extraterrestrial. Ricky Sorrells, I don't know. I think he probably feels it was not military also. Although in the beginning, he said, well, maybe this was military. And you have to realize he's a welder. He, mm-hmm. you know, there's certain things that we have the ability, that we will have the ability within 20 or 30 years, right, where you can develop things. But something that large without any type of, that's a single molded piece and that can move, that can sit still and then move at a high rate of speed. There's no way we're even close to developing that type of technology.
Yeah, right. And when you were talking about Ricky Sorrells, I believe that's what you said his name was or something like that.
Right. That's correct.
Was that a daytime sighting? It almost sounds like it was.
It was still light. The sun, I think when he started off hunting, the sun was still up, starting to go down, and it was still daylight. I think the sun may have, you know, recently set, but there was still plenty of light.
Yeah. So that, to me, sounds like one of the most amazing sightings to this whole event, to be able to see actually see the craft itself.
There were three policemen that also drew a picture of the craft, that they saw it themselves also. The policemen, though, were never willing to come forward.
Really?
I talked to them on the phone, but I can understand his reason. He told me, he said, Robert, imagine if I came forward with this story. He said, the next time I arrest a guy for drunken driving and his attorney has me on the stand, he's going to say, you accuse my, you know, witness here or my client of drunken driving. And let's see here. You're the same guy that sees UFOs, aren't you? And
unbelievable. Said, but yeah, I totally get it. Yeah,
that's
totally
what happened to him. So he said there's no way he can go public with a story.
Wow. Something else. Okay. There's a question that came up and I missed it. And so are you aware of any witnesses having, quote unquote, experiences in the years following the incident? Say, perhaps abductions or anyone having a lot of UFO sightings themselves?
I'm just thinking here. No, I don't think so. I've stayed in close contact, especially with Steve Allen, with the constable, and I'm not in them with Angela Joyner, you know, for until she dropped out about 2 years ago. But I'm not aware of anyone that, you know, had any type of abduction issues after this.
Yeah. Okay. So now I think that kind of, unless anyone has a question, they're going to pop in the message board right away. I think I really, really, like I said to you before, actually, when I met you in Phoenix, this is just one of those cases I've wanted to talk to someone about and had reached out to Angelina Joyner a number of times. So it's been a real thrill having you on, but it's not the end of the show. I wanted to ask you if you could talk about when you have been involved in MUFON doing the research that you've been doing. What would you say, besides this case, because I think this case is very, very special, what would you say is the second most interesting case, or was it O'Hare?
Well, for me, I think the second most interesting case is one that we're investigating now.
Ooh.
It's a case that happened in Canada. It was basically three individuals that were black bear hunting, and they shot the black bear, several black bear, and they were putting them in their truck. These guys live in the U.S. They were headed down a logging road. They're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no cell phone coverage or anything. And a bright light comes towards them. The main witness, who actually is, he has contracts with the Department of Defense. So, and I've vetted the witness, so I know that that is the case. So this guy's not just any witness. He's an engineer. He sees this object come, and he knows, you know, what would a helicopter be doing in the middle of nowhere late at night. So he tells the driver to cut off the engine so that they can hear better. And so this engineer says, you know, I know that we're at around 30 decibels out here in the middle of nowhere, so I should be able to hear anything.
Right.
So he hears nothing. Well, meanwhile, the object keeps getting closer until now they can see it. It's the shape of a dumbbell. So there are two discs with a bar basically connecting them. On one, the lights are rotating to the left. The other one, the lights are rotating to the right. There is what the engineer estimates is an 18-inch plasma, blue indigo is the color he used, all around the object. At its closest point, the object came within 400 feet of them, and using he had a rifle, and using his 9X scope, he was able to calculate the size of the object. This object was there for 6 minutes, and he spent 6 minutes observing the object. So the size is 170 feet across, and I verified his calculations. So this is one of these cases, right, where you either decide that these three hunters made up a story, right, or it really happened, because there's no issue of misidentification. If you calculate the angular size in the sky of a 170-foot object, which is basically roughly the length of a commercial jet, and if it's, imagine a commercial jet sitting 175 feet above the ground, 400 feet away from you, it's going to cover up most of the sky in front of you. It's just an excellent case. This guy has spent over a year trying to calculate how this object was able to, how much power it must have put out, how the object interfered with his camera system and his phone system. He did have a cell phone with him. That was the first thing he tried to use, and the battery became extremely hot. He believes that basically he doesn't think it was intentional. He just thinks that the EM field that was around the object because of this plasma that he saw just shorted out his phone. And then he had a Sony Cyber shot camera, and the camera, he'd turn it on and it would just turn off, and he was actually able to turn the camera on once the object began to move away. So once the object moved farther away, he could get his camera to work. And so he recorded a couple of minutes on his camera.
Really?
But the video is basically noise. You can hear the voices, but you can't see the object. So you can hear him talking with the other guys about, you know, what is this thing, blah, blah, blah. But you can't see it. Now, he what he feels happened, and we're trying to find some experts, like from Sony, that might be able to help us. He thinks, and I'm getting a little technical here, but he believes the EM field from the object induced a current into his CMOS chip that's on that camera, so that basically it scrambled the chip, so the chip wasn't working right, but the audio was working properly. And he believes that he should be able to back calculate the frequency of that EM field based on how it interfered with his camera. So,
wow,
this is, you know, it's just a great case. It's either, you know, these guys are full of BS, which I don't believe at all, or it really happened. And that's my favorite type of case. You know, it's kind of like Ricky Sorrells, right? Mm-hmm. He was underneath this object with, and what he saw, either it happened or he made it up. There, you know,
seems like there's a lot of hunters involved. You hear the Ricky Sorrells, of course, these hunters, Travis Walton. And there was another witness that was a hunter. You hear about hunters quite often, and it's only, in my opinion, because they're in the great outdoors.
Yeah, probably that's the what only I would reason. Think. Yeah, because most of us actually rarely look up at the sky.
Now, someone wanted to know, is there any place that someone can search now and read more about this case? It is a fascinating case.
Which one? The Indiana case?
The one you just mentioned.
If they go to the MUFON website, there's actually, it should still be on the front page of the MUFON. I'll check as we're talking here, and I think they can find it right there. The witness actually created an animation of the object and its movement. And so I'm looking at the MUFON website, and there's a scrolling part, which they call the traffic report. And yeah, it's still there. So if they just watch that scrolling, they'll see this bar-shaped object. It's and then if they click on that, they'll be able to see basically a part of the video.
Now, I'm going to ask probably a lame question, and that is it possible the guy forgot to take his lens cap off?
No.
Okay.
No. And the reason that we feel he didn't, that's not what happened, is because it's not like it's total dark noise like you get if you put your lens cap on. There's actually a point in there where, and he used some filtering algorithms to try to get out anything he could, where it looks like you can see the lights of the craft within the noise.
Wow. We should get the Roswell slide people to work on that.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Interesting case. And we have about 6 minutes left. I thought maybe you could talk about, so I love hearing about cases like this, especially when they're fresh. But what is your opinion on, I'm going to change gears here completely and not even talk about a case. I just thought of this. What is your opinion on government cover-up in the UFO topic?
You know, I see most things in shades of gray, Martin, so I'm never for certain on things. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, you know, I've researched that a lot by researching the history of the UFO phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. And that's in this book that myself and several other guys wrote called UFOs in Government. And I believe there's been cover-ups at individual points in time. You know, during the history of the phenomenon, you know, someone may have said, no, you're not releasing that report, or no, forget about that. We're not talking about it. And various people have various reasons for why they may want something covered up, right? Maybe they want a promotion, so they don't want anything going out that might affect their promotion. But so far, I've not seen evidence that convinces me that there's a secret government agency which has existed, you know, over the last 60 years, that this phenomenon has existed, and that the data, you know, and that they have a track record and they're keeping the information from the U.S. public. Now, having said that, I won't say it's not possible. I'm just saying that in, you know, the way I see things in shades of gray, I'm 80, 90% sure that that's not the case. But I, you know, if I saw the right evidence, I could be convinced otherwise.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you another shade of gray type question. And that is, do you think that it's possible that the government or military has absolutely no idea what's going on?
Yes, I think that's possible. I think, and that's because giant bureaucracies are often inept. That's why 9/11 happened to us. Because someone turned off transponders and our air traffic controllers all of a sudden didn't see the plane and the planes, and no one else reacted. So, yes, I think it's possible that they don't know anything about the phenomenon. It's almost like a social phenomenon where it's like nobody wants to think about it, right? It's like, oh, there's another one of those things on my radar screen, you know. Okay, forget that. That's just one of those UFOs. And the reason I think that could be the case is at the end of Project Blue Book, what the Air Force finally said was they didn't really say that the phenomenon wasn't real. They said it was not a threat to national security, which I don't know how they know that absolutely, but that was one conclusion. Yeah. And their other conclusion was that it didn't make sense for the Air Force to continue to investigate. So I think they wanted the monkey off their back.
Right. I do too. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't think I think there's possible that there are still investigations. I know John Greenwald found a document that pertains to NORAD actually continuing investigating. So I think, of course, if something is in our airspace, it's got to be looked at one way or the other by government to protect us in some type of way.
Right. But I think what may happen, though, is there is so much junk in space within the 5,000 miles, you know, outside of our atmosphere, satellites, broken debris, everything, that what the Air Force probably does is they probably have algorithms, right, that are programmed to recognize the trail of an ICBM, for example, or the trail of a satellite or anything in orbit. But if you have something that's suddenly moving at 25,000 miles an hour and just stops, it probably gets kicked out by their algorithm saying, this is not something of interest.
How about that? I never even thought of that. Well, we are plumb out of time, and I want to thank you so much. And name the title of the book that you have out there again.
It's UFOs and Government, A Historical Inquiry.
And is that still available on Amazon?
Yes, it's on Amazon.
All right. Robert, it's been a real pleasure, and I hope I get to meet you once again. Had a great time tonight. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Martin.
All right. So, everyone, hang in there. Just a real quick announcement. We have Jack Brewer coming up next week, UFO Trails. You can see his blog. And we are I'm going to be doing something really weird, and I thought I'd save this for the last part, is I'm going to do a benefit. I'm going to announce this right now. I can't believe I'm even doing this, but I am. I'm going to shave my head. I know, dead silence, right? It's actually, I'm going to do that to benefit kids with cancer. And I can talk about that later. If someone wants to sponsor me shaving my head, I'm going to do it. right before the show and take a picture. I can't believe I'm going to do it, but I am going to do it. I have personal reasons for that, involving a brother and all that. So anyway, that will be coming up. So next week we have Jack Brewer, and I want to thank everyone for listening. If you're listening this long, you're probably a supporter. I appreciate that very much. And we'll be back next week, everyone. Thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high.